Okay, this week we have a fairly intensive series of blocks of hermeneutics too, but I hope we'll manage. last time we introduced the course, and as I said, we will be looking at various methodologies that have been used in the last 150 years, especially to interpret the Bible, that are very untraditional, that are very, perhaps, well, I know from experience for many of our students, these are not methodologies that are comfortable or exciting or fun, but they are things we need to be aware of, whether we end up agreeing or disagreeing. Of course, everyone has their choice on that. And where we ended, yes, last time. I use some examples to show how the Old Testament authors, when they were writing their books, they were using sources. Some sources, as we saw, are directly mentioned in the Old Testament itself. So it's very clear they did use sources. They had sources available when they wrote their books. And then I introduced a theory that is not very popular, but is a theory that's kind of simple to show that it's possible that there are other sources that are not directly mentioned in the text. And that is what the methodology that we're going to be looking at starting now deals with: source criticism, the search for what they believe are the sources used by the biblical authors. And the working assumption of source criticism. Okay, the basic idea is this. The theory is that the biblical authors wove together conflicting sources to create the biblical books. Some attempt was made as they wove them together, some attempt was made to smooth out the wrinkles, the inconsistencies, the contradictions. But those inconsistencies or those bumps can still be found in the text. And those are the keys that we use to identify the sources. Okay, that's the basic working assumption of source criticism. And some of you probably noticed a couple words here that jumped out at you. Where did the word conflicting suddenly come from? Or inconsistencies? Those are not words that we usually use when we're talking about the Bible. So where did these words come from? This is a very, very important point to understand. Source criticism developed as part of a larger philosophical movement, a larger philosophical culture that is called the Enlightenment. The methodology originated in the 1700s in Europe, which was the time of the Enlightenment. And as I think you've heard before, the Enlightenment was the philosophical movement that said reason is the highest authority. Human reason, human rational scientific thinking is the source of knowledge. Everything we really know is what rational scientific thinking tells us. So reason, science, this is how we find knowledge. Science can conquer all problems, answer all questions. There's nothing higher than human reason in terms of our search for knowledge. And that is very much connected with another key word from that philosophical time period, which is deism. These philosophers were not atheists originally. because they believed, or they needed God as an explanation for where life comes from. This is before Charles Darwin, before evolution. And so they needed God as the creator. But deism, if you remember, is this worldview that says, yes, there is a God, creator of the universe, who created a perfect world designed to function according to natural laws. And then God stepped back out of the picture and just allows the universe to continue to function according to natural scientific laws. So God exists, he is the creator, but he is not actively involved in any way. So there's no miraculous, there's no revelation in any direct sense. God allows the universe to function according to natural laws. He may, behind the scenes, he is the cause of everything ultimately, but he doesn't interfere in a direct way. Which means, as I said, there's no supernatural. The supernatural does not occur. And you can see how these two ideas support each other. Enlightenment says the source for knowledge is rational human scientific thinking. If that is the source of knowledge, then you're not going to be very friendly to the idea of inspiration or prophetic revelation. Because prophetic revelation is not rational scientific thinking. It's something different, and it's something higher. And so if you think your rational scientific thinking is the highest authority, you don't want to talk about the possibility of revelation, obviously. So, whereas traditionally, this is something I showed you last time. Traditionally, the Bible said, traditionally Christians said that the Bible is the highest authority. This is God's revelation. With the Enlightenment came the shift we talked about last time, where it was flipped upside down. And human reason comes to the first place. Human rational thinking, which means rather than approaching from the traditional perspective, you read the Bible and you say, well, I have to accept what the Bible says. I can't argue with the Bible because it's God's revelation. With the Enlightenment, now, these philosophers were able to say, there is no inspiration. The Bible is what? The Bible becomes a human book about God, human wisdom about theology and faith, but it's not inspired by God. It doesn't have the same authority anymore, which means we can disagree with the Bible. We can judge the Bible. And so the Bible then, as I said, it becomes effectively a human book about God. If inspiration is weakened or almost totally taken away, obviously the different books of the Bible were written over many different time periods or many different centuries. In fact, there is from the traditional date of Moses, 1400 BC, until John writes the book of Revelation, around 95 AD after Christ, that's 1,500 years. So if you put that into more modern terms, would you expect a book written in the year 500, at the fall of the Roman Empire, around the year 500, would you expect that book to agree with a book written today? Humanly speaking, would you expect them to agree with each other in terms of their worldview, their ethics, their philosophical ideas? There's no possible way they would agree in any serious way, because life has changed over 1,500 years. Well, the same is true from the time of Moses, 1,400 BC, till the time of Jesus, the apostles, John. There's no way they would agree with each other. Humanly speaking, that's an impossibility. And so you expect contradictions. You expect disagreements, because different authors, different theologians disagree with each other. We all know that. That's human. That's normal. If you're looking at this from a human, purely a human perspective. And behind that, you see very clearly that the role of God in the Bible has been greatly, greatly reduced. I'm not saying that it's been taken away completely, because not everyone would say that, but it's been greatly reduced, and the human side of the Bible greatly emphasized. And that has continued. From the time of the Enlightenment, that approach to the Bible continued through the 20th century and now into the 21st century. Kind of a classic example of this from what you could call sort of the classical era of these methodologies that we're looking at today is a debate between two German giant Old Testament giants in Old Testament scholarship from 100 years ago, from the early mid 20th century. Otto Eisfeld and Walter Eichrod. Their books are in our library. Their books are in every theological library. They are giants in the field of biblical studies from this perspective. And Eisfeld, they had a debate between themselves exactly on this topic. Eisfeld was the Bible scholar, the Bible specialist. Eichrod was a bit more of a theologian. And Eisfeld was the one who really emphasized that, look, we need to have two different disciplines completely. In our academic study of the Bible, there should be two totally separate curriculums, two totally separate disciplines. The first would be the higher critical study of the Bible, which is the methodologies we're going to be looking at in this class today. This is what leads to true knowledge about the Bible, facts. And that needs to be totally separated from theology. Theology is something totally different. Theology is about God, it's about your faith, but that has nothing to do with the academic study of the Bible. These are two totally different disciplines. Eichrod didn't quite agree with that. He wanted to bring them together, and Eisfeld said, no, they have to be separate. Separate your faith from the study of the Bible. Study the Bible without any thought about your personal faith or about matters of theology. These things should be separated. God, in other words, faith is not a part of Eisfeld's understanding of how you study the Bible. They're two different spheres completely. And so throughout the 20th century, and still in some circles today, there was almost a phrase or a mantra that was used by people from this approach, that they say, we study the Bible as if there was no God. As if there was no God. You may believe in God. And I've read interviews by famous Bible scholars with PhDs and teach at prestigious universities, write textbooks. And they say, yes, in my personal life, I go to church on Sunday and I believe in God, but that has no effect upon my study of the Bible from Monday to Friday. They say that. I've heard them say that in interviews. I study the Bible as if there was no God, because that is how I use my rational thinking to find the truth. Faith and theology is something else. So there's a separation in this approach that's at the foundation of this approach. And this whole idea, this whole approach began with something I introduced to you in Old Testament Survey, and that is the documentary hypothesis, which is a theory about how the books of Moses came into existence. Indrek, Natasha, turn your cameras on. I just noticed you don't have your cameras on. If you're here, turn them on. The documentary hypothesis is this theory that says, I read wrong. I thought it was Natasha, but it's Nastya. Ah, that's why Nastya's not here. She's at home. Okay. Okay, the documentary hypothesis says that in the beginning, the books of Moses were not, think of it as a group. It was not one collection by one author, but it was four parallel versions of the same story, Genesis through Moses, four parallel versions of the same story, written at four different points in history by four different people with four different theological goals. And gradually they were combined, they were woven together. So first the J version was written, and then 100 years later, someone wrote the E version of the same story, covering the same Genesis through Moses. And then they were woven together, combined to create one book. And then someone wrote the D material. And then sometime later, someone wrote the P, which is the priestly, everything to do with priests. Someone wrote a version from the perspective of the priests. And that was then woven together so that what we have today in the books of Moses is this tangled, woven together combination of the four original versions. Okay, I briefly introduced that in Old Testament Survey. So when you read through, starting now in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, the first little bit, you're reading actually the words of the P author. And then you get to chapter 2, and the story changes. You get into the Garden of Eden, and the Garden of Eden is from the J author. And then a little bit later, you get a section that's from the E author. And then back to J, and then P, and E, and J, and P, and E, and D. So as we read through what appears to us to be one collection, the books of Moses, we're actually moving from one author to another. They have all just been woven together. And in Old Testament Survey, I used the example, we have four Gospels. Imagine if somebody would take the four Gospels and combine them to create one, the authoritative Gospel that weaves together a little bit from everything. And some people have actually done that. And that's what they're saying happened with the books of Moses. Okay, I'm not going to talk about this theory in detail because I'm talking more about the methodology itself at this point. So the question is, now we are reading the book of Genesis, Exodus, the books of Moses. It's this tangled, woven together, and we want to try to identify the sources. How do you identify the sources? Assuming this is true, how would you identify the source? If you want to separate them out to go back to the original sources, that's what they want to do. Well, a different source means a different author. So how do you recognize a different author? It's actually not that difficult. You look for things like a change of style, because different authors have different styles, obviously. Changes of vocabulary. My vocabulary in English is very different from Doug's vocabulary in English, at least so I've been told. That's normal. Different people have different vocabulary that they use. You can look at point three here. Look for breaks in continuity and thought in presentation. Breaks that are not natural, that it doesn't fit. It's like the story's going along and then all of a sudden it just changes. Well, maybe that's a clue that you're moving from one source to the next. Linking, connecting phrases. Again, if you have two stories side by side in the text, that are separate stories, but there's kind of one phrase or one verse that is almost like a bridge or a rope that's tying them together. Well, maybe they're tied together because originally they were separate. Two different authors, two different sources that have been tied together in a way that's not so natural. Number five, changes in theological or other viewpoint. For example, if it consistently says this person is bad, or this person is portrayed as being bad, and then suddenly the person does something good. Well, maybe that's because there's two different sources writing about the same person. And according to one source, the person was good, but in the other source, the author didn't like that person, and so he's described as bad. Repetition, number six. If you have the same story happening twice, most obvious example, creation. Genesis 1, the creation of the world, male and female, God created them. Genesis 2, the creation, Adam and Eve, male and female, God creates them both. So the story repeats. Maybe that's because one comes from one source, the other from another source. Number seven, clearly defined isolatable subunits. If you have a series of verses that all start with the same phrase, for example, or all sort of follow the same pattern, what does that tell you? Well, maybe that passage should be treated separately because maybe it comes from a different source than the passage before and the passage after. And lastly, chronological or factual inconsistencies. Simply contradictions of some kind from one passage to the next. Now, you'll notice that some of these are highlighted, are in bold. Those are the ones that we'll refer to the most often. And gradually, I hope those will kind of soak into your brain, because these are the key points for how this works. So let me give you an example, real life example of how, okay, firstly, let me ask the question, does this sound logical? Would these criteria logically allow you to identify two different authors? Is this logical? Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, good. Now that you've established that, I will tell you the story of a student. True story, I just won't give you the name. And I will also say this was a long time ago when I was a new teacher. So I don't think any of you know this person. I'm sure you don't. So don't bother wondering who it is. Okay, I'm reading this paper and it's in English, so it makes it easier. And one section of this long research paper is beautiful English. I don't write that good English. And English was not this person's first language. I don't write that good English. Doug does not use that good English. This is English on a whole nother level. This is like, wow, that kind of English. But then the next paragraph, it becomes very common English, like very normal street language, normal people English. Huge change in style. And I keep reading on. And then I read, no quotation marks, I just read, the situation we are facing in the church in Australia is, the person in question was not Australian, to my knowledge, had never been to Australia. Okay, that is a change in, where is that? Viewpoint, number five. A change in viewpoint. All of a sudden, he's talking about the problems we are facing in Australia. Okay, what happened with this paper? I mean, now we have a system where we can send a paper like that, and the internet, we have an automated program to search for plagiarism. Back then, we didn't have that, but we did have Google, I think, or Alta Vista or something. This was a long time ago. And so I just typed in some phrases and very quickly found the beautiful English was from the Vatican homepage. This was the Vatican's English. It was beautiful English. And then, yeah, some was from something written by an Australian, and this was called plagiarism. Don't do that. But it exactly illustrated this. What this student had done was to take different sources, copy paste, and weave them together. And teachers are smart enough, especially if it's in your own language, then it's much easier. With English, for me, it was very obvious. This is not written by the same person. So I think there is logic to this. No question. There is logic to this. And so this is exactly how the system works. And so what they did is they began studying the biblical texts. So they start, okay, and each block here represents, let's say it represents one verse or one phrase, or let's think of it as a verse. And as you start reading through the text, you begin to notice that these particular passages here all have certain criteria or certain common characteristics. For example, they all call God Elohim. And they all have other characteristics in common, similar style, similar viewpoint, similar theological approach. But then these passages over here have different characteristics. They are also common to each other. They all, for example, call God Yahweh. And they all have other similar style, similar vocabulary, similar theological viewpoint or message. And then you notice these passages over here, again, all have criteria in common with each other, but they are different from this collection, which is different from this collection, and so on. This is basically what they did, to go through the text like that and notice that different sections that are scattered throughout the biblical book, if you would bring them together, they would all have common characteristics. And that's how the system works, the method works. And so by doing that, then, they say they are able to identify the original sources. Why do these passages have common characteristics? Because that was written by one author. That's one source. And this is another source written by a different author, and so on. So by analyzing the text, they say they can identify the original sources. And then they can study each source separately. What can we learn about this source? What can we learn about its approach, about the theological message that this author was trying to communicate, which is different from this other author? And so on. What are they each trying to say? And go beyond the message, get into things like the date, the place of origin. What can we learn about this author? Who was he? Where was he? Where does he fit in the story of the Bible or of the history of Israel? So, does that make sense? Is that clear as a method? Any questions, comments? We're not done with it. I'm going to go on. I just want to see if you... I think like I said, when I read seminary student papers, occasionally I see this. And hopefully there are quotation marks and references. But sometimes there aren't. And that's called plagiarism. But in any case, there is a logic to this. Definitely. So what I want to do now, very quickly before the break, I think we can do this, is I want to show you how this works in a real practical example in the biblical text. And the story I'm going to use is the story of the flood. Every individual Old Testament scholar who uses this approach will come up with their own unique variation. No two scholars will agree completely on the analysis. But in general, I'm using the story of the flood following this particular author, his version. But in general, this is considered to be the strongest example of source criticism. Okay, so I'm intentionally using what they themselves say is the strongest, clearest example. So even though different scholars will disagree on the details, they will virtually all agree on the general approach, and they say this is the best example. So I'm giving you their strongest example, not their weakest example. I want to kind of emphasize that. And the general theory, general accepted theory, is that the flood story we have in Genesis, originally there were two sources that wrote about the flood, and they have been woven together. So there's a J version and a P version woven together. And we see that based on repetition, as we'll see in a moment, based on a different theological perspective, different theological message, different theological understanding, and inconsistencies. Those are the three key points for the flood story in this approach. So now this is going to be only in English. I think on Moodle I have a fully printed out Estonian and Russian translation of this, but this is impossible to do in three languages. So this is only in English. But when you start reading the flood story, you'll notice that there are actually two introductions to the story. In chapter 6, verses 5 to 8, it will give the reason for the flood, the wickedness of all men, all people. And then it will introduce Noah and says, Noah found grace in the eyes of God. And according to the theory, that is the J introduction to the flood story. But then almost immediately after, it kind of repeats. Again, it introduces Noah, but this time it says Noah was a righteous man. It's not grace, it's righteousness. Different theological view Salvation by faith, salvation by works. Is it grace? Is it his righteousness? Slight difference. The reason for the flood is given again, but this time it's broader. It's not just the wickedness of people, but it's the corruption of the earth in general. So it's a much broader problem. It's not just human evil, it's the whole earth that is corrupt. So two introductions. Then there will be two sets of instructions. Noah is told, chapter 7, the first five verses, go into the ark. God will destroy from the face of the earth every creature. It says, take seven of every animal, a male and its mate. And then it says, God will send rain for 40 days and 40 nights. And then it says in verse 5, Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. So there are the instructions God gave to Noah. But then, actually before that, in chapter 6, there was a second set of instructions where God said, make an ark. God said, he will destroy all flesh. So it's kind of repeating. This time it brings in something new. God will make a covenant with Noah. That's something new that God says here, something different. And now it says, take two of every animal, male and female. Two. Over here it said seven. So, contradiction. And again it says, Noah did everything just as God commanded him. So, two sets of instructions. And then the flood arrives. You have the coming of the flood itself, again, is told twice. And these are all the exact verses that this particular author says belong to these separate sources. The flood itself, in the J version, the flood lasts for 40 days. But in the P version, in these verses, it says the flood lasts 150 days. Now, obviously, 40 and 150 are different numbers. Obviously. All right. The flood comes to an end. According to the J version, it says the rain was restrained. The rain stops. The raven and the dove are released from the ark. The birds are sent out. And then Noah knew it was safe to leave the ark. But in the P version, it says the waters went down, and then God told Noah to leave the ark. Two different stories. And then two different conclusions. In the J version, Noah builds an altar, and God promises never again to curse the world with a flood. Okay, that's chapter 8, verses 20 to 22. But then, chapter 9, a second conclusion. This time it says God blesses Noah. And God establishes a covenant never to destroy the world again with a flood. Story comes to an end. Okay, so what this shows is, according to the theory, there were two versions of the flood story. And if you take only these verses over here, you will have a complete story of the flood. Logically, everything is there for a logical, complete story. Or if you take only these verses, again, you will have a logically complete story. So you can take these passages separate, and each one will give you a complete flood story. So the duplication, the repetition in the story is, in this case, probably the key point that they use to say Originally, there were two different stories. But there are also disagreements between them. Is it about grace or about Noah's righteousness? Is it salvation by faith or salvation by grace or salvation by works? Two different theological ideas of why God saves Noah. Contradiction, they say. Different authors, different understanding. Contradiction in the number of animals taken into the ark. Is it seven of each or two of each? Those are different numbers. How long does the flood last? 40 days or 150 days? Again, those are contradictions that suggest different author who told the story differently. And each one has its own unique ideas. Now, this is going to get way beyond what we could do just here, but the idea of a covenant is a common theme in the P sources or passages. If you look throughout the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, throughout the books of Moses, the theme of the covenant is typically repeated in the P section. That's part of P's understanding of God and how God relates to us. Whereas J, okay, let me finish that. P tends to view God as the great king. He is remote, distant, and must be approached in the proper ritual, and the covenant fits in there. Whereas J has a much more personal view of God. In J, God is much more like a human who has emotions. God feels sorrow. God appears as a man, for example, with Abraham or in other passages. So the picture of who God is different between the two authors. Now, we're not going to get into that in any detail. I'm just giving it to you as an example. So this is part of the documentary hypothesis. And as I said, this is considered generally to be the strongest example, the best example. And so I'm intentionally using what they will say is their strongest example. And they say then that this clearly shows that there were originally two versions of the flood story, written by two different authors with two different theological understandings. They've been woven together into one. That's what we have. But the duplication, the repetition, the contradictions, the inconsistencies allow us to separate them. And so then we can study them separately to understand each one as it originally was, because that's the goal in source criticism, is to understand the original source material. Okay, time for a break, past time actually. So I'll let you just think about that while we go have coffee, and then we can discuss it when we come back. Because like I said last time, I think I said this, for every scholar who says one thing, basic law of nature is there is another person with a PhD who will disagree. That's how life is. So we'll get into that then after the break. So 15 minutes.